This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Political chaos continues in Venezuela, where U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido declared himself president last month. Saturday was the deadline that Guaido and the Trump administration had set for aid to enter the country, which has been going through an economic, social, and political crisis. But the Venezuelan military, which is still loyal to embattled President Nicolas Maduro, prevented the aid from entering. And that sparked violent clashes at the Colombian town of Cúcuta. Many were injured when two Venezuelan National Guard defectors rammed their jeeps into barricades separating the bridge. Some news outlets are reporting Maduro supporters set fire to the trucks, but others are reporting that opposition supporters were responsible for the fire. Joining us to discuss all of this is Fernando Kutz, former director for South America to President Obama and President Trump. He's now a senior associate at the Cohen Group. Fernando, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Jorge Martin, secretary of the Hands Off Venezuela campaign and editor of the magazine America Socialista. Jorge, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Fernando, let's start with you. What exactly are the goals of the opposition between the U.S. and Venezuela?
Well, I think where we are now in Venezuela is we have a leader who is who's not legitimate. He's not legitimately in power. The last election in May that was held was filled with fraud and with the opposition not being allowed to run. So we have a lack of democracy in the country. And then you add on that human rights abuses that have been taking place day in and day out. The people are suffering. There's a humanitarian catastrophe. So you have a real crisis that's developed there. And sadly, it's a man-made crisis. It's not because of some hurricane or earthquake or anything else. It's just mismanagement, autocracy, and a lack of any kind of semblance of human rights or caring about that anymore.
I want to talk a little bit about the U.S.'s role when it comes to Venezuela politically. There are a couple things here. First off, you did support imposing economic sanctions on Venezuela, which many critics say led to this man-made disaster, the crumbling of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the data, you'll see that way before we started any kind of individual targeted sanctions, the economy was already crumbling. The corrupt regime has already been in place for many, many years. It actually started under Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez. And when oil prices were high, they could sustain themselves and they could sustain their corruption and still have enough money left over to support the people. But when oil prices started to tumble, which sustains almost all of the Venezuelan economy, you saw that with the money no longer there, they had to prioritize. And instead of prioritizing their people, they prioritized the mafia state and actually feeding the into the pot of the corruption instead of feeding the mouths of their own people.
We can't talk about the U.S. involvement in Venezuela without talking about a third component here, which is oil. I would like to play you a clip of John Bolton, who is now heavily involved in U.S. efforts in the region, what he told Fox Business last month.
Venezuela is one of the three countries I call the troika of tyranny. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically if we could have American oil companies really invest in and produce the oil capabilities in Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of the United States. We both have a lot at stake here making this come out the right way.
Fernando, can you clarify a little bit more about what the U.S. interests are beyond humanitarian aid here?
Well, you know, I think what Ambassador Bolton was speaking about, and I no longer, of course, represent the administration, so I'm not pretending to defend exactly the words he said. But I think as you look at the giant hole that Maduro has put his country into, it's going to take a lot of money and a lot of effort to get the people of Venezuela out of that hole. Some of the estimates I've seen include, you know, over $30 billion over 20 years. And that's frankly money that the entire international community combined isn't going to just freely throw in to help the people. But fortunately, Venezuela does have a natural resource on its own, which is oil. And I think that's where it will be essential that they get their operation back up and running to sustain themselves and to help better themselves and their living conditions, which are unfortunately so deteriorated right now because of Maduro.
Jorge, let's bring you in here. You disagree quite vehemently with Fernando. You've been leading the Hands Off Venezuela campaign since 2002. In your view, what are the goals of the United States for their involvement?
Yes, first I'd like to correct something that Fernando Kutz has said. In fact, the elections last year on the 20th of May did have opposition participation. Henry Falcón, who was at that time one of the main leaders of the Democratic Roundtable, the MUD, the main opposition body, did participate, although another section of the opposition decided to boycott the election. That's their loss. But in fact, the U.S. administration has been trying to undermine and overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela since well before there was any economic crisis. We all know that the U.S. administration participated and gave green light in the coup against democratically elected President Chavez back in 2002. And at that time, there was no mass migration, there was no economic crisis, there was no rationale for that. In fact, there's been a 20-year campaign to undermine the Bolivarian Revolution and the right of the Venezuelan people to decide their own governments. And I think this is one of the main reasons for U.S. intervention in Venezuela. The second one being oil. I think John Bolton said it very clearly in the clip that you played. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves anywhere in the world, and they are very close to the United States. And it will be very good, as John Bolton said, if for the government of the United States if they had control over these oil reserves. There's also other mineral wealth in Venezuela: gold, coltan, and other minerals. And finally, I think that when John Bolton is talking about the triad of tyranny. The attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela, to implement regime change in Venezuela by the U.S. administration, both the Obama administration and now the Trump administration, is a warning to other governments in the region, including in Cuba. Governments which have in common the fact that they do not comply with U.S. foreign policy, because humanitarian crisis there is in many different countries around Latin America, in Haiti, in Honduras, where the United States supported the coup in 2009, and we don't see any attempts at regime change by the United States. The reason is that these countries already have U.S.-compliant governments.
Jorge, I want to ask you, as it stands right now, the military still appears to be on the side of President Nicolás Maduro, or embattled President Nicolás Maduro. President Trump here in the United States has said, quote, all options are on the table, which could imply military intervention. Your thoughts on that, Jorge?
I think, first of all, this is scandalous. The United States has called for a military coup in a foreign country. This is a violation of national sovereignty. And if any foreign country was interfering in the same way in the internal affairs of the United States, there will be a hue and cry in the mass media. But it seems that this is acceptable, that the U.S. president, secretary of state, vice president, they all calling on the Venezuelan army to rebel against the democratically elected government.
Fernando, let me just cut you off there for a second, Jorge, because, Fernando, how realistic is a military intervention in your experience?
Well, you know, I think it's important to remember that this isn't a situation where the United States is treating Venezuela, you know, different than the majority of the world is. You know, we have over 50 countries now who have recognized Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela. And so I think this huge sector of the international community, including the vast majority of countries in Latin America, led by the Lima group, of course, who has not had any kind of U.S. involvement or participation in it for the most part, they've been calling for the military to legitimately follow the orders of their new president, which is Juan Guaido. So, you know, is there any kind of potential for military intervention? I hope not. I don't think it's impossible, but I hope not. If it were to happen, then I think there would have to be a very serious conversation. I think it would have to be multilaterally led as a humanitarian operation, not led by the United States. But again, I very much hope that we don't get to that.
One of the things that you mentioned, Jorge, also is that this is sort of looking at this could essentially be a military intervention. If we take a step back and look, the U.S. does not have a great track record when it comes to intervening in political affairs in Latin America. Jorge, is that your concern?
No, not in Latin America, not anywhere else. I mean, we have to remember that now there is a lot of talk about humanitarian aid and a humanitarian crisis. But before the invasion of Iraq, there was a lot of talk about weapons of mass destruction, which were never found. Then the bombing of Libya was justified on the grounds of the imminent threat to the people of Benghazi, which then was proven to be false intelligence. And now we see where are these countries today? Libya is in complete chaos. There are three different governments, warring Islamic fundamentalist factions. There are open air slave markets, and this is the result of intervention, foreign military intervention in this country. Is this what we want for Venezuela? And yes, the United States has a long history of intervening in
it
the
does, it, Jorge, it does, but yet at the same time, Venezuela itself had a very severe humanitarian crisis prior to the Guaido regime under Maduro. So the United Nations said that nearly 3 million Venezuelans have since fled the country. What is the way forward?
Yes, there is no denying that there is a very serious economic crisis with many social consequences in Venezuela. What is not usually analyzed is what are the reasons for this crisis. But certainly the solution to this crisis is not the seizing of $8 billion U.S. dollars worth of assets in the United States. It's not economic sanctions, which are hurting the people first and foremost. And it's not, for instance, what the Bank of England has done, which is seizing $1.2 billion dollars worth of gold reserves in the Bank of England, because this money could be used by the Venezuelan government to purchase the necessary food and medications, which will alleviate the situation.
Then let's talk about that.
Of the country.
Fernando, what do you think? We've got about a minute left in this segment. I'm wondering, is this a return to the types of politics that the U.S. participated in the past, similar to Allende and Pichot in Chile, for example?
You know, not at all. I think what is happening here is a legitimate humanitarian crisis. I think that every major international organization has recognized that. Most countries in the world have recognized that. If you look at the examples in other parts of the world of where the United States has also failed as far as foreign policy, if you think about Bill Clinton's biggest failure, as he would describe it himself, it was Rwanda and not intervening and not helping the people in their times of crisis. And Barack Obama, I think, would similarly say Syria, not being able to do more to help the people of Syria. So I think people who, say the United States and the rest of the international community shouldn't do anything in Venezuela, I think that's a choice, absolutely. But that's a choice that has some very serious consequences, and that the people who are suffering at the end of the day are the people in Venezuela, and it's the countries surrounding Venezuela who very well might be destabilized by the continuing flow of refugees that has just been endless to those other countries.
Fernando Kutz is the former director for South America to President Obama and President Trump, and Jorge Martin, secretary of the Hands Off Venezuela campaign. Fernando and Jorge, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the Oscar goes to, period, end of sentence.
I'm not crying because I'm on my period or anything. I can't believe a film about menstruation just won an Oscar.
I share this with teachers and with students around the world. A period should end a sentence, not a girl's education.
That's filmmaker Rika Zatapchi, as well as teacher and producer Melissa Burton, accepting the Academy Award for Best Documentary Short. In much of the world, menstruating does represent an ending. In places like rural India, it can mean the end of a young woman's ability to go to school or even to move around her village freely. And that all has to do with the shame that keeps women from talking about periods in the first place.
We were shocked just because periods are something that we so regularly talked about in our community, with our friends and with our parents, especially our moms.
Avery Siegel was a 10th grade private school student in North Hollywood when she attended a United Nations commission on the status of girls along with her friend Ruby Schiff. And it was there that they learned that one major reason girls drop out of school across the world is because they start menstruating and they don't have access to sanitary pads. In the United States, the sanitary part of sanitary pads is pretty much a given, but not in India. Ruby said that she and Avery wanted to learn more.
We discovered an Indian man named Muruganatham,
and he has a really fascinating story. But basically, he found that his wife was using rags and leaves and ashes when she was menstruating, and he wanted to do something about it, so he invented this low-cost sanitary pad machine using local materials.
Ruby, Avery, and others at their school started a fundraising drive to send one of those machines to women in a village outside of New Delhi. Using their connections to the film industry and with the help of the Delhi-based nonprofit Action India, the girls helped create a documentary about women in the village. It looks at how the pad-making machine impacted their lives and how the conversation around menstruation changed along the way. That now Oscar-winning documentary is Period, End of Sentence.
You're realizing that, oh my God, we have to make a film about menstruation, a topic that is so, you know, deeply culturally taboo.
Before she won her Oscar, Rekha Zatapchi spoke to us at The Takeaway, and she described arriving in the village for the film and asking people about their periods.
We spoke to tons of women and men because, you know, it's really important to get both perspectives. And we just walked into a co-ed classroom of 15 or 16-year-old girls and boys, and we had the teacher ask the students if they could tell us what a period was. And you see this young girl, it's at the tip of her tongue, but in the film for about 30 seconds, she struggles to say anything. And it actually looks like she's about to faint. An older woman who was about 60 years old and had menstruated her entire life, her response to us was, "This is dirty blood. This is only something that God knows." And then you ask the men and they say it's an illness. So you just see like a real kind of hodgepodge of opinions and ideas about what menstruation is. And all of them couldn't be further from the truth.
But the consequences of this taboo go well beyond shame. Once these conversations had begun, Rekha asked women what they did when they got their first period.
The response was always, "Oh, well, I didn't know what to do. So I just found like some cloth in my dresser, just like an old suit that I didn't wear anymore. And I just use that." Or we got answers like, you know, "I was totally mortified and I thought I was sick and I thought something was wrong with me, but I didn't tell anybody." And then there's the big issue of what do you do with the cloth once you use it? You have to dispose it, right? And you can't dispose it in the daytime because there's really no waste management there. So basically, the women would only have the option of burying their cloth out in the fields, in the farmlands. And during the day, the farmlands are filled with people because people are farming and working in the fields. So women would ultimately have to go out late at night, out into the fields by themselves to go bury this cloth. And that is a really, really big problem because they're more vulnerable and at risk for sexual assault and rape.
This way of managing menstruation can pose other serious health risks. The dirty rags can cause infections. Rekha says these effects can have lifelong consequences beyond physical health, too.
There are so many young women who have really had no other choice but to drop out of school. Their schools don't have toilets. There's really no place for them to go to dispose or to change cloth. And so what young women would do is often miss school when they would be on their periods. And then they would miss so much school over the course of a year that they would ultimately be forced to drop out.
And a low-tech pad maker would start to change all this.
The women basically had to tell the men in the village that it was a machine that creates Huggies diapers because otherwise there's no way that they would have actually gotten the permission to be able to install this machine there. And then we basically had to get the women kind of comfortable and trained on this machine and comfortable with the idea that they would ultimately be like the face of this product.
The face and the muscle. After the inventor trained the women to work the machine, they were on their own.
A lot of these women had never worked in their lives, let alone, you know, started their own business. Electricity is a really big problem in the villages because it's, you know, there's not a lot of connectivity there. So the machine would kind of shut down for a few days. And the women had to figure out a workaround and figure out how are we going to continue to make this product and be on deadline.
But many months later, the machine has dramatically changed the lives of many of these women who have themselves become entrepreneurs.
They are all earning wages now. And I think one woman wants to become a doctor and she's putting her money towards schooling for that.
these women have refined the pad. I mean, the pad, another funny line in the film is like, our pad is very ugly, but it's good to use. You know, at first it was like kind of look like Frankenstein. Now they've managed to create a really slick and sleek pad and use the right amount of materials. And there's been a really, really high demand for it. I think word of mouth has been spreading really quickly. And now we've actually installed two more machines in neighboring villages.
Rika told us she hopes that the project won't stop there because the problem is worldwide.
We're also seeing an issue in the United States with women who come from economically disadvantaged households and can't afford pads, and their schools don't even have pads available to them. It's a very big problem worldwide, and I think it really all starts with the taboo. If we are open and freely talking about menstruation and the importance of menstrual hygiene, I think a lot more lawmakers and people culturally will take it more seriously and prioritize menstrual hygiene. The more and more we kind of unbury this topic, the more we realize how dire the situation is in so many places and how much we can actually affect change.
Rika Zatopci is the director behind Period, End of Sentence. It just won the Oscar for Best Documentary Short, and you can find it on Netflix and see the trailer at our website, thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Robert Kraft is among the most celebrated and accomplished owners in the NFL. And on Friday, he was charged with two counts of soliciting sex at a Florida massage parlor that was allegedly running a human trafficking ring. In total, more than 24 people have been arrested and hundreds have been charged in the investigation. Law enforcement officials say women were forced to perform sexual acts, they lived in the massage parlors, and were forbidden from leaving. In some cases, their passports had been confiscated. Kraft has denied engaging in any illegal activity. But it's far from the first time an NFL owner has been accused of exploiting women. Joining me now is Jane McManus, sports writer and columnist for the New York Daily News. Hi, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
So much to unpack here. I mean, Robert Kraft has a reputation for being a billionaire businessman and owning the Patriots, which are one of the most successful franchises in NFL. But how does what is happening here square with what we know about him publicly?
Well, he's definitely one of the most, if not the most powerful NFL owner. And as you probably know, the way that the ownership structure is set up in the NFL, really, Roger Goodell is the commissioner, but he really answers to the owners, and the decision-making happens within that ownership group. So you could really say that Kraft is, you know, very instrumental in setting NFL policy, NFL tone, the business decisions that the NFL is going to make, and some of the decisions that they might make around some of these things like players kneeling and how to respond to that, and you know, what the NFL's position is going to be on that. I think these actions obviously, allegedly, and of course he denies it, and that's a very important thing to note. But if true, this certainly does not square with his public image of, kind of being someone who's an authority and an owner who sets the tone. It's also important to note that technically the owners are subject to the same code of conduct policy that the NFL has for players. And that policy states that people can be disciplined even if they aren't found guilty of crimes necessarily in the court of law. So there are all of these things that kind of go into the conversation about Kraft, his culpability, what he knew, and then, of course, we have to see as more facts emerge from this actual sting operation and if the allegations are borne out.
Jane, you mentioned policies like those that might affect things like taking a knee. And when I think about taking a knee, I think about, and I look at this, I feel very much like the NFL has some sort of a hypocritical morality stance to some of these issues. Can we talk a little bit about the morality there of the NFL?
Sure. Well, I think there's been, in some cases, a double standard when it comes to owners and players and kind of how they're held to account and for what kinds of infractions. I mean, an important, you know, thing to note is that Jerry Richardson, who was the owner of the Panthers, was forced to sell, believe last year, after some very serious allegations about harassment in the front office came out. So that was a case where an owner was held to account. So these things do come out, but they don't seem to really stick. You know, in some ways, these owners are more representative of the NFL than a player, than an individual player is. And especially one like Kraft, who has so much power. And so, you know, Roger Goodell now is in a position of essentially, you know, potentially disciplining his one of his bosses, you know, one person who is actually literally negotiating whether or not to have Goodell stay on as commissioner. And Goodell makes millions and millions, as much as $40 million a year, according to some reports. So literally biting the hand that feeds him in order to send the message that ownership has integrity. And I think that's an important message, right? Because Roger Goodell talks about protecting the shield. And if he really is going to protect the shield, then you have to protect it from this idea of exploitation. And the reason that that's important is because when it comes to women, in some ways, the NFL has been fairly exploitive. And I say that, you know, referring to the cheerleaders who had to sue in 2014 simply to get minimum wage, right? These are the most visible and largest group of women who worked at that time for the NFL. And here they were suing just to get minimum wage. Now, since then, the NFL has had its teams revamped the policies on how it pays cheerleaders. But this is in a series of incidents, and you could talk about domestic violence and the problems that the league has had with that as well. So, you know, this is a very serious point, and it's a key point, I think, for league image.
Jane, there are so many stories of players in the NFL who've been charged with domestic violence and maybe getting suspended for a few games, but ultimately they're allowed to play. You mentioned the cheerleaders who hadn't been treated well by the league, and they had to actually fight for a decent salary. What's at the heart of this type of behavior?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's about money and power. The NFL is not unlike any other institution in America or across the world. When you have money and power at stake, people feel authorized to do things that perhaps they wouldn't in other situations. And the NFL is a very powerful league, and people make a lot of money. And I think certainly, you know, in terms of ownership, where people can't really be held accountable in the same way, you know, again, Jerry Richardson and the Panthers is a bit of an outlier. There have not been many owners who've kind of been stripped of their team for behavior. And so in some ways, you have a bit of impunity to do things where you're not going to be held to account. And so I think the underlying issue is accountability and whether or not there's accountability for behavior. And that's the underlying heart of it.
And of course, the NFL can't make any money without the fans. How have fans been reacting to the news?
This, of course, is really interesting because so many times fans will just reflexively support an owner or a player that's on a team that they support. And that, I think, is ultimately why not holding players and owners account for these things is so dangerous, because you have a lot of people now within the NFL fan base who are reflexively protecting Robert Kraft. And the way that they're doing that is by looking at this and saying, well, you know, sex work isn't a crime, or he didn't know, or they're finding all of these ways to justify the cost of human trafficking. They're because they have to believe in a framework that is then going to allow them to feel like Robert Kraft is a victim, or Robert Kraft didn't do it, or Robert Kraft is somehow not in the wrong. And I think ultimately that is the cost that is paid ethically by these kinds of situations where you have fans reflexively supporting players who are accused of domestic violence by victim blaming, you know, before all of the facts come out, or even with some of the facts out. And that ultimately, I think, is the cost that is paid, that we pay culturally, when these kinds of things are not handled well by a league.
Jane McManus is a sports columnist for the New York Daily News and the director of the Marist College Center for Sports Communication. Thanks for joining us, Jane.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.